James Edward Williams versus Commonwealth, Mr. Hanna and Mr. Shandoval. Good morning.
Good morning, Judge.
Mr. Hanna, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
No, sir, Judge.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Judge, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Steve Hanna, counsel. I was appointed by the court to represent James Williams in this case. And the framework and parameters of this case were, I guess, good and bad, relatively straightforward. There's no question my client shot the victim. There's no client a wounding occurred. There's no client it happened at the 7-Eleven. The only issue before the court was that should the lesser included offense, instruction of unlawful wounding, have been presented.
Well, in your view, what is the critical distinction between unlawful wounding and malicious wounding?
Well, there is no intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill.
But that's an element of both offenses.
Well, the unlawful wounding, and that all he testified to was that he was just simply not even trying to shoot them. He was just simply trying to scare them away. And those acts are unlawful acts.
But the difference between the two offenses is malice, is it not?
It's malice, and he testified that he wasn't trying to, again, harm anybody, wasn't trying to shoot anybody. He testified that he didn't actually aim
the gun. Was there any evidence to support that?
His testimony.
Any corroborating evidence?
The corroborating evidence was, which was the foundation which I laid, which was in form of the other witnesses, his fiance who flew in from California and his brother, and of course the fiance who brought the funeral program. So all the purpose of those witnesses were to lay a foundation to corroborate his fear, his state of mind, his grief, and of course the very reason he was in Virginia to begin with. So when she took his fiance, Ms. Hall, she flew in from California, she verified that he flew in from California to Virginia for the purpose of attending a funeral for his friend. They call it his brother.
So and I get the justification that you allege supports the proposition that
yes,
it should have been something less, but tell me how we're to craft a framework to accomplish your objective. In other words, what you're suggesting indirectly is that if someone carries certain emotional baggage with them, that circumstance can justify changing what would otherwise be malicious wounding to unlawful wounding.
That circumstance is it doesn't justify it, but it's part of it. It's a piece of the puzzle. There are numerous pieces of the puzzle. That is a piece of the puzzle because it goes to show his state of mind. It shows his intent. And in this case, his intent, as he testified to, was not to harm anybody, but he was rather not acting maliciously. He was acting out of fear, and part of that fear was born of the grief of his friend.
Can we sort of follow up on that, tease that out a bit then? If he is acting just on grief, why is he, you know, involved with this gentleman who's essentially been trying to pick a fight? First with the victim's girlfriend, then the victim is very restrained. He steps in between him and he steps in between the girlfriend and someone else.
Right.
Then all he does is leave the store, and your client's friend just sucker punches him. And when he staggers back and looks as if, according to what your client testifies, that he's trying to maybe protect himself or defend himself, that's when he gets shot.
And two
shots go off,
right.
Not just one.
Two shots do go off, and
where is the evidence that this is anything but malice?
Well, if I could, I guess, address one of the premises of your questions. That he just wasn't acting mainly out of grief. The grief was, his fear was in part a function of the grief.
His fear of what?
Of the circumstances in that situation which occurred, that his friend had been murdered in a similar situation.
So he was entitled to shoot anybody because he was in fear that he might get shot because of what happened months earlier?
No.
Much earlier?
By itself? No, not by itself, but if you add A plus B plus C, so part of the A was his fear that, and again, his friend had been murdered in a similar situation. B, there were actually two guys, the victim and his victim's friend. C, there was some type of confrontation or ruckus. D, there's a previous confrontation or ruckus inside the 7-Eleven where my client goes inside, hey, what's going on? So if you look at the totality.
But there's no ruckus outside of the 7-Eleven until his friend hits the victim.
Right, and then the victim gets up and he's like in a stance, and the victim, let's be clear, he was a victim. We're never arguing against that. The victim and his friend, so now there's two guys right there. So if you look at the totality of the circumstances, everything, the totality of the circumstances, which began from his flight from California up to the actual incident, if you look at everything, and then of course my client's testimony, which he could not have been more clear. I was afraid of this, I wasn't trying to harm anybody, and
until I shot somebody twice.
But he testified, I wasn't trying to do that.
And but he's shot in the torso, he's not shot in the foot or the leg.
Right. And then the question would be, the $64,000 question is, would the jury believe him if they had the unlawful instruction? And who knows what a jury would do?
Well, they obviously didn't believe him because they found, as a matter of law, that malice existed.
Well, they didn't have the option to determine.
They got a not guilty verdict.
Right, right. But
so you argued that there's no malice finding not guilty, and they didn't buy that argument.
Well, that's true, but again, if it's an all or nothing, in which we never wanted to argue it was all or nothing, that he was guilty of a crime, and the crime would have been unlawful.
The evidence is uncontradicted that at least there was an inference of malice inherent in this case through the deliberate use of a deadly weapon. Would you agree with that?
Yes. So, a jury could find that.
So it then, the burden of going forward or the burden of persuasion then shifts to the defendant to establish that the shooting was based on a reasonable fear brought on by sudden provocation. Would that be fair to say?
Which is what we did. When the burden did shift to us, so, which was the reason to present
that? That's what I want to know. Where is the sudden provocation, and where is the reasonable belief of imminent bodily injury or fear?
Well, I would suggest, again, that was the foundation which I laid for the first witness, his fiance, the second witness, his brother, then my client himself, which laid out the totality of the circumstances.
So there would have to be sufficient. I mean, I'm trying to understand how something that happened some time ago that involved people totally alien from those involved in this particular case created a reasonable fear of serious bodily injury or death.
Well, again, because he testified, and the question would be whether the jury would believe him or not, he testified, in a situation like this, my friend had been murdered days ago, and here I am in this similar type of situation, and this thing has popped up. I see not one guy, but two guys. And he just testified he was just trying to get them, I think he said, out of the situation. So that was the whole point of laying that foundation.
Are you saying there were two guys he was afraid of there? I thought it was just the one.
No, the victim had a friend, a male friend. And they were right there.
He had his girlfriend with him, but he had a male friend as well?
Yes, okay. Yes. So there were two guys, and you know, his lady friend. Mm-hmm.
Let's take it another way, and I'm trying to follow the argument. You concede that your client's friend was the one who sucker punched the victim originally?
Yes.
Okay. In those circumstances, would your client's friend have been entitled to use deadly force?
No, because there's no, well, no, because the only way had the friend been charged, the only way he would have done that is if he himself would have laid some type of foundation.
Traditional law school analysis, the victim's, your client's friend was the initiator of the
right.
battery.
Right.
He had, obviously, the person who was the victim had not done anything to provoke this battery. So if your client were the friend, he would have had a responsibility to retreat first before he could use deadly force, assuming the victim used deadly force.
The friend who sucker punched him, he would be in a different posture.
He'd have to retreat. So how does a person who is tertiary to the situation entitled to use deadly force against the victim?
Well, he's not, which is why he would be guilty of the crime of unlawful wounding. He'd be guilty of that crime. He would not be entitled to any self-defense instruction at all. So he would be, the thing is, I'd go to the jury and say, I want you to find him guilty of a crime. He committed a crime. That crime is unlawful wounding.
Let's back up a little bit, and I appreciate this. You said, and acknowledged properly, that the difference between unlawful wounding and malicious wounding is malice. We all agree with that. What is the difference between assault and battery and unlawful wounding?
Well, the assault, well, first of all, there's no wounding.
Correct.
And the assault, of course,
Did you offer an assault and battery?
No, because
instruction?
There would have been no evidence to support it because it was clearly a wounding, and we just weren't.
But if there's justification, there's.
There was no justification for the felony which he committed, which was unlawful wounding.
Well, I thought you said there was no intent. He didn't intend to shoot the victim.
But his actions were unlawful. His actions were unlawful, and there was a wounding. So,
well, if they were unlawful, then he must have intended to shoot the victim.
Well,
if the shooting were accidental, it wouldn't be intentional.
The degree of force he used, which was a shooting, which is, even if I'm trying to say get away, but under those circumstances, that's not a proper use of force. So that is an unlawful act, which he's guilty of that.
But doesn't an unlawful act have to be an intentional act in this case?
Well, he intentionally used a gun. You know, again, it was a type of negligence.
He intentionally shot him.
He intentionally shot, but he testified he didn't shoot. He didn't try to shoot him. That's what he testified to. So, and therefore, had he missed, then he would still be guilty of a crime because there's no evidence to support the use of that force. Because if he's fearful, then you just can't use force to shoot people, get away.
I guess on some theoretical basis, you might be able to get there except for the second shot.
Yeah, I would suggest, well, first of all, the evidence was to happen, you know, very quickly, boom, boom. But as opposed to a shot, some type of moment to ponder, and then a second shot, it's very rapid. But what's interesting in this case is what I mentioned, which was the Miller case. And in that case, which was before this court, is the defendant in that case has some argument, goes across the street, gets a gun, goes back, shoots him. He admitted he did so out of anger and revenge. In that case is daunting. So in that case, this court said, you know, he should be entitled to unlawful wounding instruction. So, and what happened at trial was when Judge Dalton, he said, do you have any case law to support your assertion? So I mentioned the Brown case, which was at the state fair. In that
wasn't Miller a heat of passion case?
Well, that's what partially in that what was interesting in that case where the defendant stated he shot him out of anger and revenge.
Miller says where a defendant produces evidence that he acted in heat of passion, he's entitled to instruction on the lesser included offense of unlawful wounding. Heat of passion is determined by the nature and degree of the provocation and may be founded upon rage, fear, or combination of both, citing the Barrett case. So as I read Miller, it's a heat of passion case. And there's no evidence here of heat of passion.
Well, in this case, my client testified about his fear. And again, the fear was, which the foundation which I laid, he had fear. And maybe it was rational or irrational, but the fear, again, his friend had been murdered in a similar situation, and then he's in this given situation.
Okay, but so if we were to rely on the fear element that Barrett and Miller cite, where do you get the provocation? In other words, what was done by this victim to provoke your client to shoot him?
Well, again, it's a totality of the circumstances analysis, and that you have a victim, he then is a fighting stance, and he's got a friend, a male friend. So then there's two guys. And so, again, my client testified. He never testified, let me back up. Had he testified he tried to shoot them, then this is a very different conversation. But he didn't testify to that. He testified that he wasn't trying to shoot them. He didn't aim at them. He just tried to scare them off. And then the question is, would the jury believe him or not believe him? So, but what was interesting in that Brown case, and I'll wrap it up, is that in that case, the defendant shoots the victim in the leg, point blank range. And then the defendant's friends jump the victim, beat him up, shoot him again. So Judge Dalton goes, well, these cases are distinguishable. And I said, well, yeah, the Brown case is worse. Well, that poor guy, he got beat up, shot up every which way from Tuesday. In that case, the defendant in that case was found guilty of unlawful wounding. So I appreciate your time, and the question is, what would the jury do? And that should be their decision.
Thank you very much for your argument. Sandoval?
Good morning, my name is Chris Sandoval. I'm pleased to court. I'm here on behalf of the Commonwealth. Just like to make a couple quick points, and then I'll rest on my brief. First of all, just for the record, there are actually 7 shots fired in this case, all in a matter of about 10 seconds. The first was fired. If you listen to the video, there's about a second gap. 4 more shots in rapid succession. Then if you watch the video, the outside view, looks like he fires 2 more up into the air as he's getting into the car to make his escape. So that's actually how many shots occurred.
And just 2 hit the victim, is that right?
1 hit the victim.
Just 1?
Just 1 okay. Hit the victim, yes, Your Honor. In terms of the scope of the issue that's before the court in this case, I'd like to try to narrow that scope just a bit, because I think the only issue before the court is whether or not Mr. Williams was reasonably provoked by the victim to then shoot the victim in the torso. We have a lot of testimony, a lot of argument about, you know, what had happened 9 days earlier, what his state of mind was, what else he might have been afraid of. But there's plenty of case law here in the Commonwealth that states, and this is a quote from Arnold versus Commonwealth, which I cite in my brief, quote, where it is not the victim of the crime who invoked the defendant's heat of passion, there is no evidence to support a finding of heat of passion. So all this evidence, all this testimony about, you know, other factors that were playing into his fear at the time, all that is irrelevant. The only question is, did the victim reasonably provoke Mr. Williams' actions? And even by his concession in his testimony, he testified, he didn't say anything to us, he didn't do anything to us. At most, he turned around to see who hit him, and he stood upright as if he might defend himself. And there's case law in Virginia, I cited Harris in my brief, I'd also cite Arnold versus Commonwealth and Graham versus Commonwealth. Those are 3 cases where jury instructions on unlawful wounding were refused. And in those cases, arguably, you can make a stronger argument that the victim was doing maybe a little bit more that might have made the defendant afraid. And in Harris, the victim was holding an unopened knife in his hand, and then he ran upstairs as if to maybe get a gun. And the defendant claimed, well, I thought he made a veiled threat about the knife. I thought he might do something with the knife, so I shot at him before he could use his knife. And the court said, there's no evidence in that case that he reasonably provoked shots to be fired. And like I said, Arnold and Graham are similar along those 2 lines, and the outcome was the same in those cases as well. Finally, turning to this argument about what his intent was, what was his state of mind, the case law in Virginia as to the difference between malicious wounding and unlawful wounding is malice, whether or not malice existed. Intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill is an element of both malicious wounding and unlawful wounding. And by not proffering a jury instruction that would have allowed the jury to conclude that Mr. Williams did not have that intent, any argument about his intent is waived on appeal, because you can't send the case back down to the trial court and ask the court to give Mr. Williams jury instruction. That instruction would not allow the court to conclude that that intent wasn't there. The instruction is on page 262 of the appendix, and this is the defense instruction. And even his own instruction, it lists the 3 elements of malicious wounding, the second of which is the intent to maim, disfigure, disable, or kill. And then at the bottom, when it gets down to talking about unlawful wounding, the instruction says, if you find from the evidence that the Commonwealth has proved beyond a reasonable doubt each of the first 2 elements of the offense has charged, but that the act was done unlawfully and not maliciously, you can find him guilty of unlawful wounding. So his own instruction assumes that the jury would find that he did have that intent. So testimony about, well, I was intending to hit the ground, I was intending to shoot up in the air, all that is really irrelevant as the case is before the court at this time. So for all those reasons, unless the court has any further questions, I will rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm both convictions.
Thank you very much. We will recount.